I'm pleased this afternoon to introduce to you a man who for many years acted as the nation's chief health educator and CEO of the Public Health Service. He provided the public, that is us, the best scientific information available on improving our health and reducing the risk of illness and injury. Rear Admiral Kenneth Morituka, the former acting Surgeon General and for a time before that, the Deputy Surgeon General, has a long and celebrated career, the majority of which was spent in the Public Health Service. Over his career, Dr. Morituka has dedicated his life to ensuring that all Americans receive the best medical care and to investigating and developing solutions for those health conditions that get in the way of millions enjoying optimal health and well-being. Currently, he is the Vice President of Global Strategic Affairs for LifeScan Incorporated, Johnson & Johnson Companies. Dr. Morituka is a physician with specialties in internal and preventive medicine. Guided by his training and experience with treating patients, he puts to use his expertise in serving in many diverse positions. During the time right before he was named Deputy Surgeon General, he was responsible for the health care of 120,000 federal inmate and detainees at the U.S. Department of Justice Federal Bureau of Prisons. Admiral Morituka also has managed the National Health Service Corps and the Division of Medicine of the Health Resources and Service Administration, HRSA. The honors and awards conferred upon him were numerous and would take the entire time allocated to him to recite. Suffice it to say that he is much admired. What is noteworthy are the health priorities to which he has dedicated his time and attention. Health disparity is one such priority, but he also is committed to improvements in health literacy, promoting organ donation and transplantation, and finding a cure for diabetes. We have talked about the complexity of health disparities and the opportunities it presents for each of us to have a role. An important component of this summit is for us to discuss how we might reframe the health disparities agenda and accelerate the pace to success. Today, Dr. Morituka will present us with some food for thought. Join me in welcoming to the podium Rear Admiral Ken Morituka.
Well, my notes here say good morning, but I know that right now that's out of date because it really is afternoon. And the way that John introduced me, saying that I was going to provide you food for thought, is a little bit of a challenge, especially, and I'll mention that in a moment. But thank you, Dr. Ruffin, for that gracious introduction, and to all of you for your warm welcome. I've got to start by saying what an effective and suave leader John is. He gets things done. John called me several weeks ago and invited me to make a few brief welcoming comments earlier. And before I knew it, I was slotted for this keynote. And there is nothing more challenging than to be the last speaker between thousands of passionate but ravenously hungry health professionals. And lunch. Maya Angelou, where are you now when I need you? I'm taking her comment to heart that we have to laugh. And I hope that as I present my thinking on disparities, that we see opportunities that will put a smile on our face rather than a pathway that keeps us downtrodden and depressed. My topic, the theme of this summit, charting a new course for health disparities through science and practice, is a welcome assignment because this subject is very close to my heart. It's an ongoing commitment and a challenge over my entire professional career. When I was the acting Surgeon General of the U.S., the elimination of health disparities was one of my three priorities, together with prevention and public health preparedness. And even prior to that time, I saw firsthand the impact of health disparities when I was the director of the National Health Service Corps and witnessed the health disparities that are based on geography, on culture, on socioeconomic differences. I further saw these disparities as the medical director of the Federal Bureau of Prisons, caring for the least desirable of our society. And I'm so pleased when I look at the agenda that you are engaged in, that you are having individuals who will address these self-same topics in so much more detail. And now in my role as the chairman of the Johnson & Johnson Diabetes Institutes throughout the world, I see the disparities in health and in health services for diabetes here in the United States and around the globe. So, is charting a new course for health disparities through science and practice, is this a new direction? Or is it a reaffirmation of our commitment to eliminate health disparities? It's a commitment, not to the what, but to the how. When speaking about health disparities, I often begin by saying that the term as used here in Washington, D.C., is how we describe differences in health status between one population and another. But that definition is far too simplistic to describe what we know to be a very complex and challenging issue. There are cultural, linguistic, racial, educational, attitudinal differences that impose special barriers to reducing and eliminating health disparities. And the list of these barriers continues to include so many others, including geographic, professional, socioeconomic, and on and on. Our society is less a melting pot of multiple cultures than it is a tapestry of communities, a tapestry that is made up of the individual strands of society, the warp and the woof, the bold and the meek, the healthy and the sick, the colors and the cultures, the attitudes and the beliefs, working together and interwoven to make the whole cloth, which together forms our nation and our society. In diversity is our strength, and we must nurture that diversity to be strong. And to nurture that diversity, we must eliminate health disparities that are based on this diversity. The evolving demographics of America point us in a similar direction. We as a nation continue to grow in numbers, and we are living longer. There are changes in the ethnic composition of our population, with increasing numbers of minorities, blacks and Hispanics, Asians, Pacific Islanders. And the implications of this larger, older, longer living, increasingly diverse population is that there are more living with the consequences of the decisions made over a lifetime. Positive benefits from good choices individuals have made, negative consequences from unhealthy ones. The result is that there are more individuals living the chronic care model with chronic diseases. Historically, we have engaged for the most part in the acute care model, where an individual with an acute disease, an injury, or a disorder seeks care from a health professional who provides a specific intervention and cures the problem. The individual goes away healed. end of medical encounter. In this model, having a trained and knowledgeable and capable health professional is the key to the positive outcome. Emerging from the trends of longer lives, bearing the consequences of cumulative decisions made during those lives, are chronic health problems requiring chronic care solutions. Some are the result of an accident of birth, diseases and disorders based on the genetic makeup of the individual. Others are the result of individual decisions, the consequences of a single or a life of choices leading to a poor health outcome. And still others are associated with the environment in which individuals live, the exposure to unhealthy, unsafe, or toxic surroundings which result in disease or injury. Diabetes is one example of a chronic health problem. For type 2 diabetes associated with poor diet, lack of exercise, obesity, and overweight. 23 million Americans have diabetes today. Delay in diagnosis and definitive intervention simply means that individuals find out that they have the disease too late, when earlier identification and treatment could have changed the course of this lifelong disease. There are 7 million of these who do not even know that they have diabetes. And there are long-standing disparities among communities and cultures regarding diagnosis, treatment, and support. This is only the tip of the spear of chronic diseases and disparities. We could go through the scenarios of heart disease, hypertension, asthma, emphysema, among other chronic diseases. Diseases which require increasing involvement, not only by the health professional, but more importantly by the individual in the day-to-day management of their lives with a chronic disease. These are diseases that require that individuals better understand their diseases and take an active part in the management of these diseases on a day-to-day basis, because there simply are not and will not be sufficient numbers of health professionals to provide ongoing care for all afflicted. The numbers now are staggering. Imagine the challenge over the next several years and the next decades. Our summit over the next few days focuses on research and practice and policy. Research to discover the roots of health disparities and to identify scientific and social solutions. Activities, practices, and interventions that will help eliminate health disparities, and policies that will enable and empower people and systems to assist in this mission. Three critical themes that once again are interwoven in our tapestry of solution, each of which is important in itself, but with synergy, working together, these can enhance our ability to eliminate health disparities and to advance the health and the well-being of our nation. Our health system must focus on the person at the center, the individual in the context of a community, because the environment affects the ability of the individual to act and to make good choices. And the person at the center must be surrounded within a stable and balanced triangle of research, practice, and policy. Relevant research, accessible practice, responsible policy. There needs to be relevant and robust research that is translatable effectively and efficiently into the community and to and for the person. Research that focuses on the whole person, mind, body, spirit. Research that focuses on prevention as well as intervention, primary, secondary, and tertiary prevention. Research that incorporates the issues and the impact and the differences of diversity and diverse peoples, that incorporates the challenge of disparities. And as we speak of research, we must remember to focus on the science of the body and of the mind within a community, intertwined for the whole person. Behavioral research must be part of the agenda to help better understand what motivates us and what inhibits us from making positive, healthy choices, from which we can reap the benefits if we make the right choices, from which we will suffer the consequences if we do not. Practices. Practices must be appropriate to the community and to the person and accessible. And by accessible, I broaden the vista to include every meaning of access, from cultural to linguistic to geographic to economic, the full spectrum of our society. Practices need to be accessible with the right providers, trained and capable in the right health and cultural models, distributed in the right locations. Practices relevant to the cultures and the society and the sociology of the people we serve. Accessible by the right modes of transportation, within the right health systems, with the right reimbursement models. Because lack of access means barriers to achieving the goal of health and well-being, the goal of eliminating health disparities. Every aspect of society can facilitate access. Every aspect of society can pose barriers. And connecting these dots is critical. It's not simply a health issue. It's a transportation issue. It's a housing issue. It's a safety issue. It's an economic issue. It's an educational issue. It's connecting all of the dots to move forward in an aligned fashion. Our conversations and our strategies must break out of these silos and involve all aspects of society in finding and implementing the systemic solutions. Responsible and reasonable policies are the third side of the supporting triangle. The health realities are with us. As epidemiologists and as public health professionals, we see the issues, we see the trends from a community and population standpoint. And the person who is at the center must be assisted by policies. The economic realities are also with us. And as we make these hard policy choices, these all must be part of the calculus. An informed and involved community is critical in developing and implementing these policies. And I know that later on in the agenda, Congressman Cummings and others will address this in much more detail. In all three of these components, science and research, practice and policy, there must be shared and integrated responsibility and involvement, again, with the person at the center. However, a widespread problem is seriously inhibiting our progress, and that overarching problem is low health literacy. And improving health literacy is critical. Health literacy is the ability of an individual to access, to understand, and to use health-related information and services to make sound, thoughtful health decisions. Indisputably, low health literacy contributes to disparities and has a negative impact on health. People with low health literacy are less likely to know how to navigate the healthcare system, how to understand the basic health information, or to get preventive healthcare services. They're more likely to utilize expensive emergency care services, more likely to be hospitalized more often for longer periods of time. When a patient doesn't understand that certain factors increase his or her risk for a disease, that's a problem. When parents don't understand the importance of taking prompt action when their child suffers heat exposure or cold weather injury, that's a problem. When a patient is rushed to the emergency room due to a misunderstanding about how much medicine should be taken, how? That's a problem. The unfortunate reality is that we're largely a health illiterate society. Only 12% of adults have proficient health literacy. Put another way, nearly 9 out of 10 American adults lack the skills needed to take care of their own health or know how to prevent disease. Language barriers due to low English proficiency add another layer of complexity. We all know that ineffective communication between health providers and patients can result in medical errors due to misunderstandings about medications and instructions. Compounding the health literacy problem is the fact that most patients don't readily give up their health information. They're either intimidated by the presence of their health professional or embarrassed to admit that they do not understand what he or she is saying. It's a concern not only for those whom we serve, but also for those of us who work in the healthcare system. Every day, public health professionals are witnessing this health literacy gap. The gap is a chasm of knowledge between what professionals know and what patients understand. And the problem is bigger than many of us perceive. Even seemingly highly educated patients can have trouble understanding basic health information. Try it yourself sometime, not as a health professional, but as a patient, and see how easy or how difficult it is to understand what our health providers are telling us. I'll use myself as an example, because I have type 1 diabetes, and I have probably the best care in this nation with my endocrinologist, a clinician at the National Institutes of Health. But let me tell you, when he and I converse about my disease, sometimes I don't understand what he's trying to communicate to me. And I say, and I was the acting Surgeon General of the United States? Duh. Try it yourself sometimes, as a patient, not as a provider. We need to build bridges between what we as health professionals know and what our patients understand. And this issue of improving health literacy is not the unique realm of the patients who may have difficulty understanding. It's also a responsibility of health professionals to communicate in such a way that those whom we serve hear the message, understand the message, embrace the message, and ultimately put into action the knowledge, the science, the evidence, the counsel that we provide them, so that we can make better health decisions for ourselves. This becomes even more critical when we're talking about chronic diseases and we're talking about health disparities. Our nation has some of the world's greatest medical research institutions, but we're not fully benefiting from all of the medical advances and the tools we have in our research labs. Even our brightest scientists can't help people if the information is only known to the researchers and health professionals. And it's critically important that we transfer health discoveries from researchers to practicing professionals to the general public as quickly as possible. In order to contribute to the making of a healthier and more health-literate nation, we can start incorporating the concept of health education and health literacy into everything that we do. It's fundamental to the success of every interaction between a healthcare professional and a person, a patient. Every prescription, every treatment, every recovery. As the people we serve better appreciate and understand health information that we provide them, they will be better equipped to take care of themselves and their families. And the health of our communities improves as well. Whether you call it health literacy or something else, we can all routinely help break down communication barriers every day, during every discussion we have with anyone about disease, about healthy choices, about the value of prevention, by ensuring that people understand that they can make the right choices and that they are aware of what they can do to become and stay healthy. It's an essential tool in eliminating health disparities. The lenses through which I view this very important health issue actually are trifocals. By that, I mean I'm at the same time a biomedical researcher, a medical physician, and an individual who lives every day with type 1 diabetes. Each of these aspects of my life provides a unique and multifaceted perspective that guides how I would approach building upon our knowledge to resolve the health concerns facing racial and ethnic minorities and other populations who are faced with health disparities. Wearing my lab coat, thinking as a scientist and a biomedical researcher, I consider science to be at its best when it efficiently and effectively transfers research and knowledge to clinical settings to the general public. It can take many, many years from the time we begin our investigations to getting it out the door for implementation. And unfortunately, we do not always do our best in making science relevant to the public. We do an even poorer job of making science understandable and important to people experiencing health disparities and who have suffered long-standing health conditions. We got to make this critical link. When I served as the acting Surgeon General, I'm especially proud of how we used the Surgeon General's reports to connect science to the public as part of a strategy to improve the health of the nation. Take, for example, two documents, the Surgeon General's report on involuntary exposure to tobacco smoke or the Surgeon General's call to action to prevent and reduce underage drinking. Each of those was an extremely intense and science-driven tome. But for the average American, it was a great dust collector. It was a great doorstop because it was so dense, it was not understandable. And so bundled with each of the documents is what we call the people's piece. Each people's piece included information about what the research actually means to Americans and to their health, and what actions we can take on an individual basis to protect our health in language that the general public, not only the researcher or scientist or health professional, can understand. It's also important that we continue to expand the basic scientific research devoted to finding solutions to these health conditions that disproportionately impact racial and ethnic minorities. Tremendous strides have been made in our understanding of preventable diseases from which millions of Americans get sick and die each year. Talking with Dr. Ruffin, and having read and reviewed a lot of the reports issued from his office over the years, I know how recommendations and findings from the earliest days of that advisory fact-finding team were converted to good science. The National Center on Minority Health and Health Disparities have directly sponsored several studies on key issues affecting racial and ethnic minority health and numerous investigations through its partnerships and its collaboration with NIH's institutes and centers, as well as other federal agencies, including the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention and the National Science Foundation. There is no substitute for targeted and meaningful research as we chart these new courses in eliminating health disparities. Switching over and looking at health disparities through the lens of a physician, I must say that among my primary concerns is the role of health literacy in defining and facilitating how we serve our patients. This bears repeating for emphasis because it's critical to our ability to reduce and eliminate health disparities. Further to this point, we need to make certain that health professionals engage in a conversation with their patients and not talk at them using complicated medical terminology and jargon. We doctors are comfortable speaking doctorese, and all health professions, and in fact, all individuals involved in the healthcare system should focus on engaging people at the level of the person we are communicating with. Of course, I'm preaching to the choir. And that, in and of itself, addresses right on the issue of how to solve health disparities. You know how important communication is to health and well-being. Improvements in health and changed health behaviors are occurring across the nation because of some of the programs that were funded by Dr. Ruffin's agency, learning from the success of these activities. Healthcare providers must operate user-friendly health practices if we are to navigate successfully the future pathways in health disparities elimination. Telemedicine, or rather telehealth, addresses issues as financial constraints, lack of transportation, the stigma of certain diseases, and social and cultural challenges, among so many others, all of which play a role in the health differences of one population and another. Telehealth gets around the limitations of place and time of traditional medicine. Technology like telehealth can eliminate the barriers between the healthcare providers and the patient seeking care. The majority of people experiencing health disparities have chronic medical conditions. Cardiovascular disease, cancer, diabetes are among the most prevalent, costly, and preventable of chronic diseases in the United States. And telehealth can bridge gaps in care, facilitating communications between the patient and their healthcare provider. And of course, telehealth technology can assist in addressing the critical area of prevention in health education. Let me talk now as Ken Moritsugu, a person with type 1 diabetes, to give you an example of how telehealth can assist individuals. As I've said, I've had diabetes for years and can appreciate the many challenges facing patients with chronic disorders. When I listen to and I read about the latest advances in the fight against diabetes, I do so with a personal interest. It's among the leading problems health disparity populations face. Earlier, I noted that in the United States alone, there are more than 23 million people with diabetes. But just as relevant are the 57 million people with prediabetes. And if you add the numbers, 23 and 57, that's 80 million people. That represents over 25% of our U.S. population of 300 million. Think of it. One out of four people in the United States has or will have diabetes unless we do something about it. And each of these 80 million people has a loved one, a family, a coworker, lives in a community. Virtually everyone is touched by diabetes. And diabetes is a chronic, lifelong illness, so I deal with it as something that will be with me for the rest of my life. I see and speak with my endocrinologist directly, probably once or twice a year. But I'm communicating with him through information technology on a regular basis, weekly, or even more often. As a result, my doctor can monitor my blood glucose, my insulin dosage data, provide me with personalized counseling regarding how best to take care of myself. I can provide the information when it's convenient to me and not to have to take time off physically to meet him, and he can assess my information and respond at his convenience. I receive timely, effective health counseling from my health professional, and everyone benefits. I've learned to depend upon personal resources and recognize that I need to make health decisions for my own health and well-being. And yes, I am so perfect in following my doctor's instructions. I'm so glad that you laughed because you got the point. The mind is willing, the body is weak. And again, if as health professionals we can admit to this, why do we expect more from our patients, those we serve? And we need to understand that sometimes doing the right thing is not easy. It takes work, and we need to make it easier for those we serve to do the right thing. Before I end, there is one other topic that I want to touch on very briefly, because it's a great example, once again, of addressing health disparities by surrounding the individual with research and science, with practice and with policies. It's very personal to me, but it also touches the lives of millions of Americans daily. And that issue is organ and tissue donation and transplantation. I believe that any course of action we take in the future to reduce and to eliminate health disparities must continue to include the role of organ donation and transplantation. Twice in my life, first as a husband and then as a father, I found myself in a position where I had to decide about giving the gift of life, when my wife died in an automobile accident, and then about 4 years later, when my daughter died in a separate automobile accident. Through my loved ones, many others have gained a renewed life and a quality of life. Today, there are more than 100,000 individuals on a national list waiting for a solid organ to live or to improve their quality of life. But how many of us can really imagine what 100,000 really means? Okay. Many of us watch professional football. And there is no stadium in this country that will hold greater than 100,000 spectators. So when you watch television on Sunday or on Monday, or who knows whatever day it's on, and watching your favorite professional team play, imagine every seat in that stadium filled with an individual who is waiting for an organ to live or to improve a quality of life. And there are thousands more who would benefit from a cornea, bone, skin, ligament, or other tissue transplantation. Because minority populations suffer from many diseases that can lead to organ failure, the need for increased organ donation and transplantation among racial and ethnic minorities is critical. It is not that minorities do not donate. In fact, the rate for donation is in proportion to the minority population. However, the need for transplantation is greater. An individual is more likely to have a successful transplant if the organ is a good match. People are genetically more similar when they are of the same race or ethnicity. So a good donor match is more likely if the donor and the recipient are from the same background. The National Center for Minority Health Disparities has played a leadership role in pushing to expand the numbers of racial and ethnic minority organ donors. It helped launch and continues to support the renowned Minority Organ and Tissue Transplant Education Program, MOTEP. And I'm privileged to serve as a member of MOTEP's National Advisory Board. There is no better example of a successful partnership between two entities than the NCMHD and MOTEP. This acclaimed program serves as a model of the types of activities we must remain committed to in order to reduce and eliminate health disparities. So in closing, let me encourage each of you participating in this summit to take time and assess what you are doing to reduce and to eliminate health disparities. This is our opportunity to share our experiences with each other, to identify how to address this issue, and to learn from each other. What is it that you are doing that works in your community, and what does not work? Are there indicators that show a need for refinement in how you conduct your investigations? Does a patient's continued health problem suggest the need to employ new treatment strategies that include a different way to connect with that patient? Or is there a fundamental need to improve health literacy for providers and for patients? And this brings me back to charting a new course for eliminating health disparities, with the person at the center of the triangle of research, of practice, and of policy. The challenges we encounter in health disparities are long-standing and complex. We must be emboldened to chart new courses in the what as well as the how, and to forge new partnerships to connect those dots in our shared goal to reduce and eliminate health disparities. We have a great opportunity at this summit where so many of us who are dedicated to reducing and eliminating health disparities are gathered here with a singular mission and with a deep-seated passion. You have this opportunity. The place is here. The time is now. The opportunity is with us. Because by doing so, we will improve the health and the quality of life of people in America. And we will dignify the lives of those we serve.
Ladies and gentlemen, I know of no one else in this country who could have connected the dots better than Ken Marasuga. Thank you so much, Ken. There are a few housekeeping issues that we want to get to your attention at this time. Joyce, could you come?
Good afternoon. I'm going to be very, very brief with you. There are but a couple of things I need to share with you. First of all, the disc containing the CD containing the abstracts are out at the information desk, so you can pick those up at any time. Secondly, we're going to start the sessions at the breakout sessions at 1:30. So we're going to allow you a little time to have lunch. And and the real biggie is to tell you the time of the shuttles. There will be two shuttles, one at 5 p.m. and one at 6 p.m. So enjoy lunch.